This is an AMI podcast.
Hey, Dave Brown here. If you enjoy this podcast portion of our show, remember you can watch it live every day at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. I'm Dave Brown. It's Wednesday, March the 29th, 2023. Coming up in the second hour of the show, with Shake Shack making its way into the Canadian food marketplace, having that presence in the Canadian market. And myself and Elizabeth Moeller will discuss good social habits to create inclusive spaces for friends with disabilities. Think about a social occasion and what you can do to make your friends feel a little bit more included. Before you get any of that, here is the regional news update. Beginning in British Columbia, BC's health minister says the province is taking action to prevent the mass exportation of a diabetes drug to the U.S. Adrian Dix says thousands of prescriptions for Ozempic went to Americans in the first 2 months of 2023. Two Metro Vancouver pharmacists and one out-of-province doctor are responsible for thousands of prescriptions. Dix says he's pushing through an amendment to limit the drug's sale to non-Canadians to avoid a shortage in the province.
I'm requesting that the Federal Minister of Health, the Honourable Jean-Yves Duclos, review the Food and Drug Regulation under the Food and Drug Act in collaboration with provincial health ministers to address the concerning number of Ozempic prescriptions emanating from practitioners in one province and take action to ensure and to protect the supply of drugs such as Ozempic for Canadians.
Over to Ontario. Ontario Premier Doug Ford has weighed in on recent violence on Toronto's public transit system. Ford wants more security presence within the TTC.
We need full-time police officers in the busiest transit system in Canada. We need to give them the resources and give them the help. But enough's enough with this crime.
Ford also offered some political consulting for people running in the mayoral by-election.
I've never seen anything like it. That should be the number one issue for any mayoral candidate. And the mayoral candidates that say they want to cut funding for the police, they want to defund the police, don't vote for them. Simple as that. Support the candidates that are going to fund the police.
Finally, in Atlantic Canada, the New Brunswick government is proposing amendments to the Motor Vehicle Act aimed at curbing excessive speeding and improving road safety. Under the changes, motorists caught driving between 50 to 80 kilometers per hour over the speed limit would have their vehicles impounded for 7 days, in addition to the current penalties of a $500 fine and 5 points off their license. Those caught driving more than 80 kilometers per hour over the speed limit would have their vehicle impounded for 30 days, be fined $1,000, and lose 6 points off their license. So that's your look at the regional news. Here's Brock Richardson with a sports chat. Brock, you and I have been celebrating all kinds of parasports over the course of the last couple of days, and an event caught your eye in the Vancouver area for Wheelchair Rugby Canada.
Yes, Wheelchair Rugby Canada is holding an open practice at the Richmond Oval on April 5th and 6th from 2 to 4 p.m. Pacific time, and this is a real great opportunity to check out some high-level athletes. It's not too often that national teams open their doors and say, come on, come check this out. So it would be a great opportunity to check that out, and as the event happens, I'll report on it and just remind people that it is happening. But I have an interesting story on an open practice.
So tell me.
We did the same thing in 2009. We were at a international event in Montreal in April, and the week before we decided to have an open practice so the public could come and see us. And anyways, we got the day started 9 a.m. in the morning, and we're warming up, doing our thing, and a bunch of people came in and didn't know who they were, obviously, and they came in and they said, oh, we're from the Center for Ethics in Sports. Each one of you is now taking a drug test. Ooh. In your open practice. And so that's what surprised us with our open practice, was a drug test, which was fun and not expected. But then you get the chaperone following you around all day until you produce what they want you to produce. And yeah, it's all good. So that was the extent of our open practice. And yeah, it's one of those things you always have to let the center know where you are and where you're practicing. And they decided to take full advantage of the open practice. But then we had some kids join us as well as the day went on. So it wasn't all bad. But that was my lasting memory of the open practice in Bocce in 2009.
Well, don't worry, Brock. We never do any drug testing, surprise drug testing for the sports chat, which is good for everybody involved. Brock, I've got a follow up question on that. That you mentioned the possibility of where elite athletes end up being drug tested by WADA or USADA or whatever particular governing body is taking care of the anti doping at that time. How much detail of your life do you need to share with those anti doping agencies? Like you mentioned, obviously in terms of where you're going to be practicing at public events, but even if, like, for example, you're going on vacation, do you have to alert them about that kind of stuff?
You do. The national teams, most national teams, I'm not going to speak for all of them, but most of them get a cell phone paid for by Bell, which is free all across Canada and into the United States. You must declare that phone number to whichever the center is that you're having to abide to, and they can call you at any point and say, where are you? We're coming to, you know, get you to give us a sample, and you need to tell us, and you need to tell them within about 2 hours where
wow.
you are. And
wow.
So if you're leaving one place and moving to another, by the within that 2 hour span, you need to be where you say you are, and they're going to be coming to you. I've never quite heard someone say, yeah, I'm in Aruba, and them say, okay, we're coming to Aruba. I don't know how that works, but I have heard people have been New Year's Eve parties and where are you? And we need to know. And then,
oh my gosh,
you're chaperoned. So I was never a lucky winner in that regard, but I have had a few experiences where they just shown up at different sporting events and said, can you do this? And you kind of go, yeah, I guess so.
We don't have a choice. Hand me a little bit of water. Hand me a little bit of water and we can make this happen. Brock, yeah. I got to tell you, man, if I was a WADA, World Anti-Doping Agency agent, I would 100% be keeping track of these Aruba vacation schedules. I would just be hunkering down in January and February, testing any athlete that comes through, you know, just I'll set up my own little outpost out there in Aruba. Brock, let's jump over to some different news in the sports world. This is not news, but tennis player Bianca Andreescu suffered a major, major injury on Monday night in the tennis world. Had to be taken off the court in a wheelchair. Appears to have some kind of cast on her foot. Brock, I don't think we have an official update on the tests or the x-rays or the MRIs, but either way, this is really bummer news for Bianca Andreescu, just as the major season of tennis is ready to kick off.
Yeah, and it really is a bummer for her. I was watching a sports show last night, and they went to a clip where going into her round of 16 game, she was talking about how she's in a really good place, and she feels much better this year than last year at the Miami Open, and she feels like she's in a really good place, and then this injury happened. And if you have not seen the video of the injury, if you have a bit of a weak stomach, I suggest not to watch it, because her ankle turns in ways that I don't think is natural. So this is a problem. But yeah, when she got carted off in a wheelchair, I knew that this was not a, you know, 2 week, 3 week kind of deal. I think her season is going to be cut very, very short, which is really unfortunate. And it seems, Dave, every time we get talking about Bianca and doing well and in a better mental space and all this, something like this happens, whether it's a foot, an ankle, a knee, a leg, whatever, there's always something with her. So I feel really bad for her scenario, and I hope that she recovers quickly, but I don't think we're going to see her on much of this tour, just based on what I've seen regarding the injury.
Oh, it's such a bummer. And she's still so young. It feels like that US Open she won was a million years ago. It was only 2019. She was so young. There was so much potential. But Brock, in a sport like that, to be dealing with bone breaks, oh, that's going to be a tough rehab, especially on some of those hard courts like the US Open or like the Australian Open. Oh, that's going to be brutal. Oh, it's going to be brutal.
Yeah, and I mean, I love watching Bianca's game. I love the energy she gives. I love the progression she's had. But when we get the ball rolling, something seems to stop her. And the more of these injuries she has with leg, foot, knee, the more likely it is that her career, and I hate to say this, but her career is going to be cut short because, as you mentioned, broken bones, those things are not easy to recover from, and then let alone bounce back and be 100%. So wish her all the best.
Absolutely.
But it's just seeming to be her luck right now is not so good.
Oh man, tennis is a tough one. Tennis is a lonely, lonely sport. And when your body finally betrays you, oh, it's really hard to come back from. But hey, like you said, I don't dwell on the negative. Wish her the best. Hope for some optimism. And we know certainly she'll be back on the tour, whether it be next year or late this year in the season. And wishing her well in that rehab. Brock, we talked quite a bit about an NHL lineup that was very interesting last night. Let's round up some of those results. I came out here and said, Tampa Bay Lightning, they're coasting to the playoffs. They're not going to worry too much in a marquee matchup against the Carolina Hurricanes. Oof, Brock, they opened up a can of whoop-a-bottom on the Carolina Hurricanes last night. Tampa Bay Lightning making some statements here.
Yes, and it was all because of what you said. That's what I'm going with. It was a performance like I was not expecting. And the note that I have written here is teams like this just scare the pants off me because it's like man, if you have the ability to go on a 3-4 game losing streak and then just come out against a team like Carolina who is no slouch and just say, yeah, we'll just drop a 4 spot and life is fine. It's no big deal. That's a team that scares me. And I get scared in all sports of teams like that who can just say, yeah, we'll just turn it off for the first half of the game. And then second half, we'll just, blow it open, So, this opened my eyes to, is Tampa taking the foot off the gas? No, clearly not.
Just a ho-hum season for Steven Stamkos as he scores his 31st goal last night. Ho-hum season for Braden Point as he scores his 46th goal. Ho-hum season for Nikita Kucherov, who registered his 100th point on the season last night. Yeah, just a bunch of ho-hum Tampa Bay Lightning being dominant on their way to another Stanley Cup final. Brock, the game that I think was most jarring last night, though, is the Winnipeg Jets laying an absolute goose egg in San Jose against the Sharks, and that playoff race, I keep wanting to write off the Calgary Flames, and now with the same amount of games as the Winnipeg Jets, they're just 2 points behind the Jets. The Jets are falling out of the sky here, Brock.
They are, and I wasn't going to preview the Calgary game yesterday morning because I just, whatever, it's Calgary, they're going to do what they do, but yeah, for me, I am disappointed in the Winnipeg Jets, and I have some alarming concerns. Last night in the post-game press conference, Rick Bowness said that there are some guys that are not giving it their all, and they are not emptying the tank. I totally get why coaches say this to kind of, shake the cage, but if you're giving your coach the perception that you're not emptying the tank and giving it all that you have at this point in the year, then what are you doing? If you're not able to get up and say, we're going to do this, and you're giving that kind of perception, you don't deserve to make the playoffs. And maybe the Nashville Predators or Calgary Flames do actually deserve because they are playing hard. And if guys aren't giving it their all, that's not fair. And I want to preface once again, I do recognize why coaches say what they say, but if that's his perception, that's a dangerous place to be.
Yeah, if you can't empty your tank as your playoff spot is slipping away, when now we're not just talking about the theoretical of you losing your playoff spot, we're talking about the very practical, as you lose to the team who's last place in the league, and not just lose, get absolutely blown off the ice. Yeah, that's not good. That's not good. Hey, Brock, no, I know there's a big Leafs game on national TV tonight against the Panthers, so you enjoy that one, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
We will, and hopefully we'll talk about that one as well tomorrow morning.
Hopefully some good news in one way, shape, or form. That is Brock Richardson. He is the host of The Neutral Zone at the AMI Sports Desk. Alex Smythe is at the AMI Weather Desk.
Here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada, starting off in Corner Brook, Newfoundland, where it's mainly cloudy with a chance of snow or rain this afternoon. The high is 3 degrees with a slight wind chill of minus 4. In Charlottetown, PEI, it's mainly cloudy with a chance of snow this morning and then clearing up. The high is plus 4 with a wind chill of minus 6. In St. John, New Brunswick, it's cloudy, becoming a mix of sun and clouds this morning. The high is plus 7 and the wind chill minus 6. To Quebec City, Quebec, where it's sunny, becoming a mix of sun and clouds this afternoon. The high is plus 5, but there is a wind chill that makes it feel like minus 10 today. In Toronto, Ontario, it's a mix of sun and clouds with heavy rain or snow expected to start this afternoon. There's also wind gusts up to 50 kilometers per hour, and the high is 8 degrees today. In Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, there's snow off and on today with up to 4 centimeters set to fall. There's also wind gusts up to 60 kilometers per hour. The high is minus 2. With a wind chill of minus 14. And now for some sunshine as we make our way to Brandon, Manitoba, where it's mainly sunny today. The high is minus 5, but the wind chill is bitterly cold at minus 33 degrees. In Regina, Saskatchewan, it's mainly sunny as well. The high is minus 4, that wind chill minus 28. In Lethbridge, Alberta, mainly sunny. A high of plus 5 with a wind chill of minus 11. Over to Red Deer, Alberta, where it's mainly sunny, increasing cloudiness this afternoon, and so it's going to be a high of plus 4, but the wind chill still at minus 19. In Whitehorse, Yukon, it's mainly sunny this morning. The high is plus 2, wind chill minus 14. And the sunshine continues in Kelowna, BC, where it's sunny, becoming a mix of sun and clouds this afternoon. The high is plus 12, but there is also a wind chill that makes it feel like minus 6. And finally, in Vancouver, BC, it's mainly sunny today and a high of 13 degrees. And that's our AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Alex. We'll talk to you a little bit later in the show, but coming up next, with Shake Shack making its way north of the border, Kevin Shaw will discuss American food brands and their presence in the Canadian market. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. American restaurant chains continue to make their way into Canada. Shake Shack plans to open a Toronto location in 2024. Brands like Chipotle have become commonplace over the last 15 years. Even Chick-fil-A broke into the market and has been expanding in the last few years. I've been watching them build a chain right here in the shops at Don Mills for the last 6 months. But what place do these brands have in the Canadian food landscape? Kevin Shaw can offer some insight on this. Kevin is the host of AMI's Mind Your Own Business. Hey, good morning, Kevin.
Hi, Dave. I want to go to there.
I like that. We're getting the taglines in here early today. Beautiful. Kevin, you and I have talked about the difficulty for retail stores moving north of the border last week. How is that landscape potentially different for food brands?
Well, you know, food is something we all need. If we don't get it, we die. But, you know, there's a lot of brand equity around food that I don't think surrounds retail, right? You know, burgers are one thing, hot dogs are one thing, pizza is one thing. So, you know, we want to try new variations on a theme. You know, restaurants obviously do very, very well wherever they go. They're convenient. And as I said, there's a lot of brand equity built up in these things. And there's a little bit of a, you know, an aspirational quality to, you know, to some of these restaurants.
Yeah, Kevin, I like that you identify that, because so many people, when they watch TV or they watch YouTube or they spend time on social media, a lot of food brand familiarity exists in a way that maybe a retail store does not. You might know the name of a retail store, but you haven't heard someone describe the bacon cheeseburger or describe the bacon wrapped hot dog. I don't know why my brain's going there at 10:22 a.m. Eastern time, but that's just who I am. But we know that not all food brands or restaurants are created equal. To your mind, what's the distinction between, say, a fast food or a fast casual restaurant, something like a Chipotle, versus more of a sit-down restaurant, like, say, I don't know, like a TGI Fridays? It's like never tried to make its way north of the border.
Well, I think so they're called QSRs, quick service restaurants, and you know, those are your Wendy's and your Burger Kings and so forth. They do well because so much of that process is mechanized and automated. You know what you're getting. There's a time limit to get your order done. You know, the staff is easy to train. A lot of the franchise work has been done for you. And it's basically just, you know, find a location that works and, you know, put the items in place that you need in order to start selling. With a sit-down restaurant, or what are called FSRs, full-service restaurants, there's so much more than just you know, having the food there and your branding and your marketing. It's you've got to consider ambiance, you've got to consider location, you've got to consider lighting, you've got to consider staffing. You know, it's very, very difficult for a you know, even for an independent restaurant to get going and to stay consistent. And it's really easy to see why, you know, even Canadian chains expand very slowly in the full service restaurant space.
Yeah, there's so many breaks in the potential chain of service at a full service restaurant, right? There are so many things that could lead to a bad experience that just don't exist in quick service. That anything could go wrong when you sit down for dinner, whereas if you're just getting a bag of junk, it's much easier to get it and get out.
That's right. You know, just put this in your car and drive away. And I mean, the other thing too is real estate, right? It's way easier to, you know, have a facility that's 1,000 square feet versus, you know, 10,000 square feet, that you don't have to pay rent for. So, you know, that's why quick service restaurants are easy to establish.
So thinking about real estate, but maybe even more broadly, right? Not real estate in the micro, but real estate in the macro. How can geography play into the success of a brand? So for example, Shake Shack is launching in Toronto, but our senior producer and your friend, Andrika Delanerol, was giving me a history lesson yesterday on Subway. The first Subways opened in Newfoundland and Labrador, as opposed to one of the major markets. Why might brands consider starting in a smaller market?
Well, it's like having an off-Broadway production, right? It's your chance to shake out the flaws, to get out all your mistakes, to figure out what's going to work in that particular community, how to innovate, how to do more with less, you know, how to be resourceful. So you might not have the footprint of you know, going to a market, let's say like Cleveland or Cincinnati, which are still, you know, they're big cities, but they're not New York, they're not Los Angeles, they're not Chicago. So here in Canada, usually if you want to test market something, you go to London or you go to Calgary, and that's your chance to make all your mistakes, to shake out all your flaws, and then you go into a bigger market like a Montreal or a Vancouver or Toronto.
You mentioned Montreal. I'm going to tell you a story from my own meandering personal experience. In the fall of 2006, the dreams of snacky Montrealers came true when the first ever Taco Bell opened in Quebec. It used to be Montrealers would drive to Cornwall, Kingston, or Plattsburgh, New York to get their hands on Taco Bell. So when this restaurant opened in the West Island, there were lineups out the door. A few years later, that location closed and there's no more Taco Bell in Montreal. So what can a business do to move away from maybe being that novelty spot? You used the word aspirational before in your first answer, and I think that really applies here, right? That maybe you want to be there and be hip and be seen when something opens, but then after the first or second time, you're like, okay, I got my pictures on the gram, I'm good.
Yeah, you know, I think like the same thing happened with Krispy Kreme, right? You know, everybody raved about Krispy Kreme when Krispy Kreme came here, and you stood in line and you got your free donut, and it was like, okay, you know, that's it. And in the end, you know, a whole bunch of locations closed, and just still like one left somewhere in like Mississauga or something. But you know, to your point, I think it's really hard to create that kind of legacy. You know, we've been in the community for the past 25 years. We've helped with these initiatives and so forth. You know, there's a certain element of that that has to grow organically, and you can't just drop something off of a, you know, off of a helicopter, have it parachute into your community and have it become this overnight institution. You know, it takes time, and companies that expand really quickly go away really quickly. You know, I think we've seen that happen with some other chains, much to my chagrin. You know, please just bring Arby's and Quiznos back. They're dwindling and they're dying, and we need more of them.
Okay, so that may lead me into my last question here, because you are a business-minded individual, hence you being a great host of Mind Your Own Business on AMI TV, and as you've described yourself, a recovering entrepreneur. Kevin, yeah. If you could open any American food franchise in Canada, what would it be? And I'll tell you my answer first. It would be Sonic. I love their stuff, although as I reflect on this almost immediately, sitting in a parked car in the dead of winter may not be super appealing to Canadians. So this is why I'd be a terrible business person. Let's hear from a good business person.
I mean, White Castle, because everybody wants to do the, you know, the Harold and Kumar road trip to White Castle. I think something like maybe Jack in the Box would do really well here. You know, they're obviously really successful in the States. So I'd choose White Castle, maybe not In-N-Out. I've been there in the States, and it's, you know, you get it once and it's like, really, this was it? Like I'm eating food in my car. This is not great. I think something like Jack in the Box would actually do really well here with their all day breakfast. So.
Oh, I love it. So just so you know, in our control room, Daniel Penamondo definitely would vote for In-N-Outs, but I like your Jack in the Box suggestion. Curly fries on the menu. Love me some curly fries on the menu. That we need more curly fries in this world.
I agree. Bring back Arby's and Quiznos.
We've got the trifecta right there, and we'd be happy to take their sponsorship dollars on the show as well. I would eat a Quiznos sub on the air every day if that's what it takes. Kevin,
right?
Thank you for this. Always a pleasure catching up with you. We'll talk to you again in a few weeks.
Okay, thanks, Dave.
That's Kevin Shaw. He's the host of AMI's Mind Your Own Business. Coming up next, we'll talk about good social habits to create inclusive spaces for your friends with disabilities. Elizabeth Moeller and I have a few thoughts on this one. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. You cannot spell social function without the word fun. Womp womp. Except if you aren't offered an accessibility accommodation, it's much harder to have that fun. And I'm not just talking about physical accommodations. I'm talking about good social habits your friends have to make you feel more included. Elizabeth Moeller has a few suggestions on those good social habits, and so do I. Hey, good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Dave. You're right. You cannot spell a social function without fun. It is very true. I'm loving the puns. How many words? Like, we could do anagrams here. How many words can we get out of social functions?
Oh my gosh, Elizabeth, don't start with me. It's we're 93 we're 93 minutes into the show. My brain only has so many sparks left in it. Although I appreciate you appreciating my joke, even though I womp wand myself. That was just for Michelle McQuigg of the Canadian Press. I know she would have wanted me to. Elizabeth, let's jump right into this off the start. When you enter an event, what can someone do to offer some advice on the layout of the room or rooms?
Well, I think I want to actually back up even more before I enter. So when I'm thinking about going and I'm registering and I'm actually encountering this as we start to gear up for academic conference season, there's some things that folks can do right in the registration process and on their website. So when you're talking about your conference, be very clear to talk about what accessibility features you have. Is it wheelchair accessible? Is everything on one level? Do you have ASL and captions? Do you have attendant care services? Do you have the ability to waive a fee for a support person? Are you going to have your presentations recorded? Is it hybrid? There's all kinds of things that you can do. And listing what you're going to do on your website, actually right out of the gate, allows me to think about, do I actually want to attend this event? Is this going to be something where I feel included?
So I like
right
that.
Right before I even think about, am I going to pay the $500, $600, $700 to go to this academic conference, I know what I'm getting into. So now let's talk registration. I know what's available, what's not. If you can, it's really helpful in the registration to ask people, what accommodations would you need to participate in this event? Now be careful, because if you're asking people for that and they list something, you either have to provide it or be able to explain what alternatives are available. So don't say you're going to provide accommodations and then not. That's happened to me at events before. If you can, waive the fee for an attendant or a support person. When you have a disability, there are so many hidden costs to attending events. And one of those is paying for or bringing a support person. And a lot of us do need that assistance. The other thing with registration, dietary restrictions. Don't have peanuts. It's just silly. And really make sure that you're catering to folks, not just with dietary restrictions, but also religious or cultural observances where folks might not eat or prefer to eat certain foods. Thinking about the length in the registration, I really wish that academic conferences would offer, a partial day or one day registration. So many don't. And for some of us, our energy won't keep up for 2 or 3 days of an event. So offering folks flexibility, as well as the idea that you might want to consider hybrid if you can. So maybe people want to come to Denmark to attend your conference, but they can't quite afford the flight or it's not feasible with their disability. So having a hybrid option is really important.
Okay, I like that. You laid out a lot of groundwork. And just so you know, Elizabeth, we talk about a lot of those things on the show frequently with contributors like Kelly Braun Johnson of Completely Inclusive. So thank you for sort of creating that reiteration. But I want to go back to my first question. You get to the event. What can somebody do to offer some advice on the layout of the room or rooms?
Okay, rooms. So when you get to an event, one of the things that would be really helpful is to have, if possible, somebody provide a visual description of the room. So this could be when you come in saying, right at your right is the registration table, straight ahead are the round tables, there's about 8 chairs. The other thing that people can do is offer sighted guide. Would you like some assistance to navigate the room? I find it helpful actually to walk around the perimeter of the room and get familiar with the room prior to everybody else coming in. Because when people are there, bodies are there, it's a bit harder to do that. So having a little bit of time just prior to navigate. I think another thing that folks can do is keep layout consistent. So again, with that orientation, not moving things around where possible is really helpful. But I think also just asking, what do you need to be oriented to the space? Because maybe it's a space I know and I don't need anything. So asking those key questions right up front is really important.
Yeah, I'm not someone who necessarily needs a description of the room, but I do the same thing you do, Elizabeth. I like to get to functions early before maybe the music is blaring and the lights dim down real low to do a lap.
Isn't there a song about that? Lights dim down.
There's probably been a song or two written about that. I like to do a full lap and get a general feel for the space before there's large crowds, low lights, and loud music. But I will say, to the credit of a lot of my friends, they do know if we wander into a place a little bit late, they will sort of offer up that advice and say, hey, bathroom's over there, bar's over there, our table's over here, and then you can try and figure it out on your own. So my friends definitely know, even if I don't get my exact desire tire of being somewhere early, and sometimes that's my own fault. They do a nice job of offering some of those basic descriptions as well. Elizabeth, one of the big things for me, though, due to my legal blindness, due to the fact that I'm partially sighted, I am really bad at recognizing people. It's something that I just do not have in my abilities to do, at least easily. Sometimes I have to scan the old database up in the brain pretty quickly to put it together. So how about good habits in regards to people introducing themselves or people mentioning who's in the room as they begin a conversation with you?
Yeah, the introducing oneself is really important. So, you know, I find it really helpful if people say their name. So rather than just coming up and saying, hi, Elizabeth, you know, hi, Elizabeth, it's Dave from AMI, to give me a little prompt as to where I might know you from. It's really helpful if people are leaving a conversation. So we've had a chat and you're stepping away, just say I'm stepping away. So I'm not continuing to talk to you with nobody, which is very embarrassing. And I'm sure it's happened to all of us.
Yeah.
And I think too, you know, the other thing that I do when I'm sort of interacting with someone and introducing myself is I put out my hand first for the handshake. Now, I know in COVID we weren't doing that. I know some places are starting to slowly come back to that. That way you're not sort of wondering, is there a handout? Where do I find it? So that's like one little tip that I find really helpful. I think the other thing in terms of people introducing themselves is to just be very clear. You know, there are times where people have said, oh, I helped you a couple of years ago, and I have no context for what that is. So just clarity about where I might know you from in the context, like I said, it is really helpful. And I think in terms of starting an event, if you are the keynote or you're presenting, just a very quick audio description of your surroundings. So, you know, I'm Elizabeth, I'm wearing a sweater with white and gray patterns, I'm sitting in my home office. It doesn't have to be lengthy and exorbitant. The reason I like a little bit of an audio description of who's up there is it tells me who's not in the space, who's missing from the space, and why are they missing. So that audio description can be really helpful in sort of piecing together larger systemic issues about who's included at events.
Elizabeth, you were mentioning in your first answer the sort of pre-work or preemptive work you can do about these good social habits. One of the things I enjoyed about a lot of events being made on Facebook in the sort of height of Facebook and Facebook events is that you were able to go down the guest list and who was going to be attending, or at least in theory, who was going to be attending before the event started. I always found that was really helpful to kind of give myself my own sense of who I might run into that night so I could start mentally preparing myself.
Yeah. And actually, you know, it's funny you say that, because now with so many events being on Zoom, I can do the same thing. I can just look down the list and be like, oh, Dave's here. I'm going to pop a private message to Dave and say hi. But that's harder in a real live space where we don't have the privilege of reading a name tag necessarily. So again, you know, another thing too, that's really helpful is if you're doing small roundtable work at conferences, just doing a quick round robin of, you know, who's at the table. So people can say their names, if they're comfortable pronouns, maybe where they're from, you know, what their background is, just so you know, again, who you're talking to and how to frame those conversations.
Elizabeth, you mentioned as well food. And one of the things you mentioned was dietary restrictions, whether those be nutritionally restrictions or whether it be cultural restrictions. And you're right on the money there. More neutral food is always a good idea that adheres to multiple dietary needs. But I'm wondering about your general preference in the way in which people may present food to you at an event. Do you prefer people handling sort of a preparing of a plate for you, walking you over to the buffet and describing everything? How do you prefer people handle that aspect of orientation?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think my answer would have been different 3 years ago before COVID. So I personally like to go up with somebody and see what's available and then select for myself, you know, maybe have them put it on the plate, but indicate what it is I'd like. I am very mindful of food waste. And so I don't like people just going and saying, well, I got you a bit of everything. A, it's not safe from a dietary perspective. And B, when you can't see, that's just not a very pleasant experience. So I think it's really important to ask people, what would you like? Would you like to go up with me? Would you like me just to get you a bit of everything? And don't be, you know, offended depending on what their answer is. And I think for me too, you know, it helps me to kind of know what the layout is. Is it a buffet? Is it family style where folks have dishes on the table and you're just serving yourself? So yeah, I think there's a lot to consider there. And knowing too, if you are assisting somebody may choose not to eat for a whole bunch of reasons. It could be, you know, they're observing a religious or cultural holiday, but it also could be with their specific disability that they're just not comfortable in that space to eat, and that's okay too. So just being very mindful. Food's a very tricky space to navigate.
Yeah, that's one where I know I asked you the question. That's almost a very personal rule rather than a sort of universal rule. So definitely that's worth consultation with people. But I would say if I were an event organizer, if I am going to do the buffet thing, I would just make sure there's kind of a lot of space between dishes on the table.
Yes.
So it's easier.
Crowding.
Yeah. And it's also easier to put your plate down and serve yourself.
Yes.
Like if you are going to choose to serve yourself, make it a little bit easier. I would also say, again, this is a low vision perspective, right? It's a legal blind perspective. If you're going to label things, can you please put big, high contrast, easy to read labels? So I'm not sticking my face into a hot plate to read what something is, because that's unsanitary in and of its own way. But,
I went to a couple of events recently that were put on by the National Educational Association of Disabled Students, and they did a brilliant job. They had box lunches. You registered and told people in advance what it is you wanted. There was options. And then you just went, you picked up your box lunch. It had a lovely wrap and some salad and bag of crisps and a drink, and you went back to your seat. And there was it was a lot easier. We weren't spending hours trying to figure out lunch and take all the plates away, but it also made it a lot more hygienic as well as equitable and accessible.
That's exactly what they did at this By Hook or By Cook AMI Connect event that I emceed and hosted a couple of weeks ago. Well, I invited you many, many times on air via the hot sheets, but you were in Toronto and it was in Calgary. And that's exactly what they did. They provided boxes for the lunch with a beautiful sandwich from a local sandwich shop with beautiful homemade chips and a beautiful homemade cookie. And it was just so easy. Boom, 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 boom. You grab your box and away you go. Really, really, really well thought out and well done on their end. So a big props to the folks who have put that one together. Elizabeth, we're running a little short for time here, so I'm going to combine these two questions. How does the size or nature of an event impact how rigorous you are about these accommodations or asking people to adhere to some of these social habits? Because I would tell you, if it's a small casual event, I'm going to be a little more lax about it. But if it's a larger scale event, or especially a professional networking event, I'm going to want people to really adhere to these habits.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. If it's an event where, for me, it's actually not so much size, it's how well I know the folks in the event and at the event and the setting it's in. So if it's a large event at somewhere that I'm very comfortable, like my choir or church, I might be a little bit more relaxed. But if it's an event that's an academic seminar or a conference, or I'm going to a roundtable discussion, then I might be a little bit more rigorous about figuring out, okay, what do I need in advance? Because I'm presenting not just my ideas, but myself. And so I want to look competent and confident, and I want people to be able to assess me on the merits of my ideas, not how well I got around the room. And I also, the other piece for me too is, if I'm focusing and stressed about how I'm navigating the space, then I'm not putting the attention that's needed into my work. And that's where it becomes a little bit more tricky. So for me, it's about, who is the event with and what is my relationship to the event.
Elizabeth, this was fantastic. This was something you suggested a few weeks ago. I'm so glad we had the follow through to put this to air. Well done by you.
Me too. This was fun. Thank you, Dave. Well done by you too. And enjoy those box lunches if you get one again.
This hour of the show is making me very hungry.
Me too.
That's Elizabeth Moeller, community reporter and columnist on Now with Dave Brown. Coming up after the break, you'll hear what's coming up on Kelly and Ramya later this afternoon. And Alex Smythe has a question about tangible skills that you could learn in school. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Looking ahead to this afternoon, Kelly and Ramya hits the airwaves at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI TV and AMI Audio. Ramya Amuthan is the co-host of that show and is here with a preview. Hey, good morning, Ramya.
Morning, Dave.
So, Ramya, what do you have coming up on the show today?
We have Margaret Weldon joining us for In the Know, and she's starting this series, she says. It's called Creditors Policies, Scam Artists, and Mental Health Effects. So we've talked about
wide-ranging over there by Margaret Weldon.
Yes, but definitely some tie-ins, right? So looking forward to what she has to share on that, maybe some personal experience. Also, Thaw de Gras took place in our community reporter in Dawson City is going to tell us more about it because UConn, it's a big, big deal over there. And I'm looking forward to what she has to say and how she reviews it. Also, we're talking about the American Printing House for the Blind because they have a new product empowered at aiming blind students in the classroom. And we're going to learn more about that initiative.
Right on. Sounds like an amazing show. Ramya, because you did such a nice job previewing the show, you get to hang around for this roundtable conversation with Alex Smythe. Alex, you got to thinking about tangible skills that we learn in school.
Yeah, Dave. So it's all about, you know, what is really applicable in our day-to-day life as adults. I mean, we always had certain courses you had to take in elementary school, high school, and then you could kind of decide and pick and choose what you really wanted. So I really started to think, okay, well, what areas or aspects of adult life did I feel I didn't learn in school? So things that I wish I had learned would have been something around finances and financial planning and how to fill out tax forms, things like that, to, how to really like do basic computer networking, understanding computers, and even something like home economics is what it was called when I was going to school, where it's just learning skills on cooking and baking and just how to manage a household. Those are all skills in my mind I feel should have been taught more specifically and more intently in school that really wasn't. You could take those courses, but it was never really front and center. So I wanted to open it up to the roundtable. And Nisreen, we'll start with you. Like, what is a skill or a knowledge base that you wish you learned in school that you didn't?
I wish I knew how to buy a house more. That
just takes money. That's just money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Money. Yeah.
Hand Nisreen a bag of money. That would be a good class.
No, honestly, it's so difficult. I wish we knew more about money in general, like taxes, buying a house, buying condos, like what it takes to the process of all of it, being in debt, you know, things like that. We never really got into it. Instead, we focused a lot, and it might be my opinion only, but for years, we focused a lot on Shakespeare. And for me, and again, this could be different for anybody else. It depends on your field. But for me, it was really pointless to me that it was taught for so many years.
Okay, so Nisreen.
Hater.
Yeah, the Nisreen, anti-literature position over there with Nisreen. She wanted a class on Marlowe, not Shakespeare. That's how Nisreen wanted to roll. Ramya, what was a class that you wish they'd had for you in high school?
Alex's example of finance, anything finance, financial literacy, I think. And the reason why I say this is because so many of us come with so many different experiences in life with finance. Like our parents have different ways of handling finance, or maybe it's not even talked about till you get to a certain age. As a person with a disability, like when I got my first debit card, I felt like the whole world changed, you know, and I had no idea how to really go about getting this information and what was the right thing to do, what was the wrong thing to do. So I think it's just empowering to learn about finance from a young age. And also, you know, on that kind of same note, anything lifestyle, right? Like nutrition, phys ed. I know we had gym classes, which I barely participated in.
Dodgeball. Let's see how good Rummy is at dodgeball.
Like it just made no sense to me, but you know what I mean? Like having physical fitness in your life, or having a well nutrition or well balanced nutrition in your life, these kind of things. Again, you don't know what your families are promoting at home or how that lifestyle stuff is set up for you. So I think school is a great opportunity since you're there like all day to have great influence on these subjects, right?
Yeah. In some cases, you have to be careful because people might actually perceive you as trying to maybe whitewash, like a school trying to whitewash some of those things, or being like too agenda driven in regards to finances. But let's count it around the table as everybody voting for sure on better personal finance classes. I was really lucky to have a civics teacher who spent part of the civics course talking about financial systems. But I do think things like like learning to do your taxes would be way more useful in a home economics class than learning to sew a pair of boxer shorts, which is the reason why I got kicked out of Royal West Academy, which is an accessibility story to tell another time on another day on this show. But yeah, learning to do my taxes would have been much more useful than learning to sew a pair of boxer shorts. That would have been much, much more useful. But I also went to school during the Stone Ages. Like, I graduated high school in 2001. So yes, there were computer science classes and some computer classes, and we did do some website building in Mr. Gill's computer class and Mr. Morrow's computer class. But definitely that was something where if we'd learned a little bit more about coding or networking, I would have appreciated it. But again, because I went to school during the Stone Ages, it wasn't necessarily like that capacity was there or that accessible or that knowledge base had necessarily trickled down in that full way. So yeah, I would have loved some more coding and computer engineering and networking engineering as part of the education. That would have been super useful to me. Alex, what was the most useless thing they taught you in high school?
Oh, well, I mean, there's so many things that just did not like, to me, math was always such a struggle, like, especially grade 11, where it just got so theoretical, and I knew, I'm not becoming an engineer, I'm not becoming a mathematician, I'm not pursuing, you know, a PhD in mathematics, so I don't need to know about the volume of a parabola and all these types of things.
Trigonometry, but, when triangles became circles, yeah. I was out.
That made no sense to me. And then the other thing, I took a computer class, but the focus of it was AutoCAD, which was literally just graphing, you know, images on the computer. And it's like, again, I it was such a specific skill set that the class could have been a lot more broader. It could have dealt with more functions of the computer itself instead of this very specific program and this very specific focus of what we're teaching you for this semester. It's like I came away with no real knowledge base from that. So that was really where it was really useless for me.
There's 55 seconds on the clock here, guys. So I've really got to hold you to quickness on this. Alex, one high school teacher who you want to give a little bit of love to today.
Mr. Bright, he taught me how to be creative and view things through a different lens.
Nazreen, one high school teacher you want to give a little bit of love to today.
Mr. Sturgeon, the biggest influence in my life.
Ramya, one high school teacher you want to give a little bit of love to today.
Mrs. Fleet, she made Shakespeare super fun.
Mr. Desrochers, my grade 9 civics teacher, who was also an economics teacher at St. George's Academy, he changed my life completely. Very, very smart man. That's all the time we have for the show today. We're back again tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Eastern time. Until then, I'm Dave Brown, reminding you to play safe, play fair, but don't forget to have some fun. Hey, Dave Brown here. If you enjoy this podcast portion of our show, remember you can watch it live every day at 9 a.m. Eastern time on AMI TV.
Hi, I'm Jenny Bovard. Join me monthly for Low Vision Moments, where I speak with awesome guests about some of the amusing things that happen when you're blind or partially sighted. Watch on YouTube or download Low Vision Moments from your favorite podcast distributor.